Okay, let's welcome Dave Bacon. So Dave did his thesis work at UC Berkeley, where he was instrumental behind the invention of decoherence-free subspaces. He went on to work on some complexity problems in quantum computing at Caltech as a postdoc, and is now a postdoc at the Santa Fe Institute, where he is beginning to think about naturally fault-tolerant quantum computers. So here you go.
Well, thank you for that nice introduction, and it's nice to be here. Today I'm going to tell you a little bit about how and what to quantum compute, but I think before I begin, I should probably apologize. I'm going to apologize because I've lived almost my entire life in California, and I've been told that in the state of Washington, that's not perhaps the nicest thing. But I will say that I grew up in a very small town of Yreka, right down here at the bottom. Here's Seattle all the way up here. So I was almost born in Oregon. In fact, here's Yreka, and here's the Siskiyou Summit, which some of you may have known Yreka because you may have been stuck in the snow near Siskiyou Summit. And here's the hospital in Oregon. If my mom had listened to the doctor, I would have been born in Oregon. And I think that's probably a sin by Washington standards, but maybe not quite as big a sin. So what do I want to talk about today? But today I want to talk about what I think is probably one of the more interesting intellectual explosions that's occurred in the last few years, and that's molding two things which have shaped, you know, the 20th century. So here's my history slide of the, you know, two fields, computation and physics. Both of these have seen, you know, an amazing amount of progress. Physics has elucidated the Standard Model. We've invented quantum theory, which seems to describe everything around us. On the other hand, computation has impacted our daily lives, and we now have, you know, computing power which is beyond my imagination and beyond all of our imagination and continuing to grow. So today what I get to talk about is combining these two things. And in particular, I get to talk about quantum computation, which is going to be molding these two in a very nice way. And there's sort of some arguments that you can start to go through about why we should start to worry about quantum computation. The first thing is the historical argument. And this is you know, the famous plot of, you know, here's the year on the bottom, and here's future size for chips, you know, for our transistors and our chips, basically. And you project this out, and, you know, you eventually hit something that where quantum effects become very important, somewhere around 2030, 2040. So you go, well, we got a lot of time, right? We don't have to worry about this. Notice I've also put the obligatory biology component of my talk on the slide over there. So any funding agencies, you know, want to talk to me, we have that side over there. And so you might say, well, this is interesting, if, you know, and this is, you know, an interesting thing to think about, but, you know, you can't use this to predict the future, right? You know, prediction's difficult. And I heard this described the other day as a lot like driving down the road by looking in your rearview mirror. So, you know, whether this means that eventually we're going to hit quantum theory or not, you know, we're not quite sure. But it's clearly something's going to happen in quite a few years. So just to remind you, because, you know, this is computer science, I'm going to remind you what quantum theory is. Well, quantum theory is basically, the way we should think about it, is it's the machine language of the universe. So you might ask, well, you know, quantum theory was invented a long time ago, you know, in the 20s and 30s, physicists invented quantum theory. Well, what have they been doing since then? You know, well, they've been doing a lot, and what they've been doing is taking these forces. These are really the programs, though physicists call them Hamiltonians and Lagrangians, and they've been elucidating that structure, right? So they have the four forces, maybe gravitational force. It's, of course, one of the big things that physicists spend, or theoretical physicists spend a lot of time thinking about. But all of these fit on top of quantum theory. Quantum theory is the basic language for which all of these forces now operate in. So they're the programs, and this is the basic language of the universe is quantum theory. So like I said, 2040 is a long ways away, right? So why should we worry? Well, fortunately, people did start worrying. And in particular, one of the first people to worry was Richard Feynman, a physicist from Caltech. And what he did was just make some simple observations. Feynman had a long-standing interest in computation. He was in charge of computation at Los Alamos during the making of the bomb. At that time, computation meant people, you know, working on calculators. So it was a little different computation. But what he observed was he observed that it's very, very difficult to simulate quantum theory. And physicists, you know, pound their heads against this and try to simulate quantum theory over and over again. Every time things, the quantum part of the theory became important, it became very difficult. But on the other hand, if you have a system in your lab and it's evolving according to quantum theory, then it effectively, efficiently computes properties of that quantum system, right? We can do an experiment, make a measurement, and that will be the result of some quantum evolution, and then we've, you know, effectively carried out, this quantum mechanical simulation that we couldn't do classically. So what he asked was just that simple question: how can you simulate quantum mechanics? And then he suggested that the way to simulate quantum mechanics was actually to use a different kind of a computer which operates according to quantum principles, and this is a quantum computer. So this was a worrying physicist. He spent, you know, a few years working on this. This was in the early 80s that he introduced this. And then something happened, which is that not much happened for, you know, 10, 11, 12 years. And then a bit of an explosion occurred, and this began really in 1993. There was some prior work, but this is really the main work that really got people excited, which was the work of Umesh Vazirani and Ethan Bernstein, who demonstrated that actually these quantum computers can offer super polynomial speedups over classical computers. And that was followed very quickly by another result due to Dan Simon just across the road here, who was able to show that there's actually an exponential speedup for certain Oracle promise file problems. And then immediately, so same Fox here, which I guess is how you measure years in computer theory, you have Peter Shor's algorithm in 1994. And what Peter was able to show was he was able to show that you could actually efficiently factor integers, and you can efficiently compute the discrete logarithm if you have a quantum computer. So this set off an explosion. It's the next slide. So this set off an explosion because, of course, factoring is related to the famous RSA public key crypto system. So here's a very large number, which I have very tediously and carefully, you know, factored into two prime numbers. And the best classical algorithm we have for this is exponential n to the 1/3, where n is the number of digits in this number, whereas Shor's algorithm takes a time n squared log n. Okay, so this breaks the RSA public key crypto system, and if you say that loud enough, I guarantee that the NSA will come down and give you a lot of money. So this generated a lot of excitement, and what happened is in 94, this is a graph of the papers in QuantPH, which is the archive where a lot of quantum computing papers end up. What happened is after that, there was an explosion in interest in trying to understand every single information processing task that you can possibly imagine and re-examine it in light of the fact that the machine language of the universe is quantum theory. So there's been this explosion in basically the invention of an entirely new field. And QuantPH, which is not all quantum computing, but a large number of them now, is almost now as large as the HEPTH, which is high-energy physics theory. That's the TH. And that's basically string theory papers. It's almost as large as that. So there's been this huge growth, and there are now a huge number of people working on this. And like the title says, boom, it just, you know, exploded. So what is quantum information science? Well, like I said, it's really not just about factoring. It's about a lot of other things. It's pretty much everything you do in a computer science department, or if you're a theorist especially, anything you can think of, people have started to think about this in a quantum area. So they just started mashing them together, right? Well, you know, that's kind of interesting. Okay, we have quantum physics on one side, computer physics. Now, if you're a physicist, on the other hand, you do the other thing. You know, you have quantum physics and computer science. You take every single physical system that we know of that we can manipulate in some quantum way. So we have ion traps, optical lattices, all of these different physical implementations of things that are doing quantum computation, and you mash them together. And you end up with this, right? And so quantum information science is about combining these two, but it's also about not just combining them to see what happens, but it's about getting results when you combine them. So there are basically four holy grails of quantum information science, four things that people are really looking for. One is an exponential reduction in quantum resources over classical, whether those are time resources, space resources, communication costs, anything you can name. When you can reduce the resources by an exponential amount, you know, that's a holy grail because that's really a motivation to build a quantum computer. There's also cases where there's an impossibility of some classical task. So this is how quantum cryptography works, where it's just not possible classically to do this, but because of the laws of quantum theory, it allows you to make crypto systems which are unbreakable. So there are often times where you just can't do the classical task at all, but quantum mechanically you can. The other holy grail that people work on is trying to understand methods of building a quantum computer. So how are we going to actually make these computers when we're dealing with the fact that we're dealing with single quantum systems? One thing about quantum systems, they don't like to remain quantum. They like to fall apart, and they like to decohere. The fourth sort of thing that happens is that people are actually experimentally implementing the pure quantum evolution, or as pure as they can get, in different physical systems. So they talk about, you know, taking off the optical lattice, doing a particular experiment, and showing that it has very good coherence properties. So these are sort of the four things that occur when you take those two, you know, take everything and mash it together. The top two being more relevant to computer science, the bottom two being more relevant to physics, but these middle ones have some crossover. So what I want to talk to you about today is I want to talk to you about two things. One is I want to give you a sense as to what we understand about what gives quantum computers their power. So what is it that's actually essential to that speed-ups when we get those exponential speed-ups? And the other thing I want to talk about is how we're going to build one. Okay, so these are sort of the two big questions, I think, that haunt the field. You know, what can you do with it, and how do you build it, right? And hopefully I'll give you some feel for what people's current thoughts on that are and my own take on it. Okay, so in order to do that, I'm going to go through very quickly. I'm going to tell you this is, you know, quantum theory 101, and it's going to be from the perspective of, you know, quantum theory is not that crazy, and there's not much different you need to change in your thinking about what's going on. So when we compare quantum theory, I'm going to compare it to classical, and I'm going to compare it to a classical theory where I just have some bit strings, and if I want to describe these bit strings, right, I do this with probabilities, right? Standard thing, you have, you know, three bits, and we have our eight states here, and we have probabilities for each of those, right? Probability observing the fact that we're in 1, 1, 0 is then to be this now P6, right? What happens in the quantum world? Well, in the quantum world, all that happens here is that we map over these probabilities into amplitudes. So now we no longer describe the state of our system. So this is these numbers here, these eight numbers, describe the state of our classical system. Now to move it over to the quantum land, all we do is we change those probabilities into amplitudes. These are numbers between 0 and 1, and they're complex numbers. Their modulus is between 0 and 1, so they're complex numbers, and they square to identity. They sum all of them to identity. There we go. And the probability of observing of a particular state, now like this 1, 1, 0 state, is now this amplitude squared. Okay? So all you do is you're now describing your state, but you're doing it by these other numbers that are not probabilities, but when you square them and add them all up, they behave like probabilities. That's easy. Okay? So that's what the information, that's the description of the information. Now we need to talk about how things evolve. Well, we can talk about classical evolution. Well, what is classical evolution on some, you know, you have some bits sitting there and you're going to do something to them, right? Well, things can happen, you know, you can write some chart for the input, output, and then these things can also make transitions with certain probabilities. So here we have 1, 0 going to 1, 1 with a certain probability Q, right? And we could just write down a transition matrix for this, right? So this is just the transition matrix describing, we have a description of our state. As an input, we have now the operation we apply, which is some stochastic matrix, and out we get our answer, another description of the system. Quantum mechanics, same thing happens, but now we have amplitudes describing our system, right? So we have now have to have description from amplitudes to amplitudes. And so again, we can describe this by just some matrix. So here an example of a matrix. And the condition that this matrix has to satisfy is that it's unitary. Okay, so you want to preserve probability, so you might guess that if I want to preserve probabilities, remember that all of these squared, when I squared them and added it up, I got 1, I want that to be maintained from input-output. Well, from just that observation, you should be able to check that this has to be a unitary operation. So what does that give us? What does that immediately sort of say? How is it different? You know, it doesn't look that different when you first look at it. On one hand, you have evolution, some probabilities, input-output, now they're amplitudes, what's really going on? Well, the first effect that you start to notice a difference is interference. So imagine you have the following transformation. So with some amplitude, you go from 0 to 0. With another amplitude, you go to 0 to 1. Another amplitude, you go to 1 to 0. And these are all equal amplitudes so far. But now to make this thing unitary, I actually have to make this thing a minus sign here, going from 1 to 1. So this is the input-output. If I put in the state in 0, it comes out with an equal superposition of 0 and 1. So let me show you what that looks like. Okay, so here's the transition. This is, you know, like the stochastic matrix, but now it's a unitary matrix. So I have a qubit, so that's what we use to describe the case where we just have a bit, and we're talking about the quantum description of it. That's the qubit. So we can possibly put it in two things. We can put it in a state where we have 1 over square root of 2, 1 over square root of 2 for each of its amplitudes at 0 and 1, and then we could measure it. 50% of the time we get 0, 50% of the time we get 1, right? Because we square these amplitudes to get the probabilities. We could also stick a minus sign in that second one. And now when we measure it, what happens? Well, we get 50% 0, 50% 1. So it's sort of like they're the same system. But there's something that interesting that happens here. If we now apply this transformation, which is called the Hadamard transformation, so we apply this transformation to the quantum information, we get interference. So when you apply that, do your matrix multiplication, you'll see that all of the, in this first case, the output state has all of its amplitude in the 0 state. It's 1, 0. So you're 100% of the time, you'll get 0. Whereas 100% of the time, you'll get 1 in this other case where you started out with this phase. So the fact that you can, you know, when you have probabilities, if you were to talk about this and talk about, you know, some Markov process and think about these as probabilities, they're always positive, right? Here we can have negative things, and so they can interfere. And that's one of the important properties. It's not the essential property, but it is an important property that distinguishes where quantum computers are getting their power. Okay, so what do quantum algorithms look like? So quantum algorithms, what you do is now you talk about, you have your quantum information, and it comes in to the system, and now we apply some sequence of unitary operations, those Hadamards of the previous thing and the unitaries that I had on a couple slides back. And you apply a sequence of those, and the sequence of those will transform the quantum information in a particular way, and then you can perform some sort of measurement and actually read out your information, just like you could have a classical computation, input probabilities. You do some evolution on it, you make a measurement, you get out some results, right? So this is a circuit for the Fourier transform over Z2 to the N, and this is essential in Shor's factoring algorithm. So what's happened in quantum algorithms? Well, after Shor's algorithm, there was another algorithm called Grover's algorithm, which was discovered, and this is for searching an unstructured database, and it gives you quadratic speedup. So it's interesting, but we really like exponential things. We like it when we gain a lot. We're greedy. And so people have been looking and have started to look even more recently in times for algorithms where we get exponential speedups. So here's a list of sort of the current, I would say, list of major algorithms that people have talked about. One of the more impressive ones is Pell's equation here. Sean Holgren was able to show in 2002 that quantum computers could efficiently solve Pell's equation. There are some hidden shift problems. A graph transversal problem, which is, has an exponential speedup, and then some various other ones that don't have exponential speedups, which are fairly interesting. So what's happening is we're slowly starting to learn that quantum computers can do other things, but we really don't have any guide as to why we're getting speedups and why we're, you know, sometimes we get polynomial speedups, sometimes we get exponential. What's actually going on there? Where is the power coming from? Because we'd like to do this because we'd like to do more than just factor. Right? We'd like to solve some very hard problems that you know, people besides the NSA care about. So how do we go there? Well, one way to go there is to understand where the power is coming from. So in order to introduce where I think the power is coming from, I'm going to introduce some results which will sort of give you a feel for why I think what I'm going to talk about is essential for quantum algorithm speedups. So let's talk about minimizing the algorithm. So here we have the classical situation in communication complexity. Two parties, Alice and Bob, they're separated over some vast distance. Alice is, I guess, down in her hole, right? And Bob's over in Jamaica, right? And they're separated by some distance, and they want to compute some joint function. So they want to compute a function jointly of two variables, A and B, which they each have. So in this example, you could do the equality function. Right, where it's 1 if their strings are the same, and it's 0 otherwise. Right, so this is the famous question of communication complexity. It's the question of how much do they need to communicate, how many bits do Alice and Bob need to exchange, in the worst case, to compute this function. Right, so with no error, you know, you can do n plus 1 if they both want to compute this, they can just exchange their bits. Right, using a little bit more sophistication, you can now ask, well, what if they, you know, fail with some probability, and then you can actually do this with log n over epsilon. So this is a classic example of something that you might want to study, right? You might want to understand what exactly is the communication complexity. And this was defined by Yao a long time ago, 1979. And there's this, many of you are probably familiar with this nice book by Kusha Levitson Nissan in from 99. But what's really nice is that you can do that mashing thing, right? Now you can say, well, what happens if we allow them to communicate instead of bits? What if they are allowed to communicate qubits? So here Alice and Bob are exchanging qubits. And Yao was the first one in 93 to actually ask this question. He asked the question, you know, what happens when we allow quantum communication? And what's really amazing is you can see that he doesn't age very much in between these two pictures. So what happens in quantum communication complexity? Well, the first thing you learn when you... So there's a very old theorem called Holovo's theorem from... Oh, it's got too many E's in it, too. Theorem. Okay, so Holovo's theorem is a sort of nail in the coffin when you first read it about it, can you get any speed up? And it asks the question, let's say we communicate qubits. So now we're going to use a quantum channel. But I want to send classical bits down that line. So I want to send, you know, I want to send my email across a quantum channel. Well, it turns out that Holovo's theorem says that sending in classical bits over quantum channel in an information theoretic setting requires in qubits. You can't stuff more classical information into these qubits. Okay? But that doesn't satisfy, you know, when you think about computing this, you know, this function, that doesn't necessarily rule out the fact that qubits can't help, right? And in fact, what Ron Ross was able to show in 1999 is that there do exist functions which require a certain number of bits to use when you're doing it classically, and even when you have error, but that can be solved using exponentially less qubits. So you can use less qubits to compute this joint function than if you had the classical case, and you get an exponential saving. So this is, again, one of these holy grails of quantum computing. So that's interesting. We see a place where we get some speed up. Now, I want to cast it in a slightly different form than this. Here what I've done is I've changed bits to qubits, but what I want to do is change it to bits and something else. So I'll explain to you what that something else is. So what I get to do here is fun. I get to demystify what teleportation is, because everybody... You know, whenever I'm in an airplane, what is this quantum teleportation thing, you know? And so it's really not that mysterious when you remember that quantum states are a description of the system that we have. So suppose Alice wants to send a bit, a classical bit, to Bob. Well, you know, if Alice is not too lazy and she wants to, she can just walk across and give it to Bob, right? Well, there's another way they can do it, and this other way has some interesting properties, right? So what they could do is, a long time ago, Alice and Bob could have gotten together, and they could have shared two bits, A and B, and these bits are correlated. So our description of the system is, we know that 50% of the time those bits were 0, 50% of the time the bits were 1, right? So then what Alice can do is, if Alice's bit is 1, then she can flip the bit, send it over to Bob, and then Bob can now look at what he got. He got Alice's bit. And then he can, if his received bit is 1, he can flip it, right? So this is just using a secret shared keypad, right? So they're just sharing this correlation. But what's nice about this is somebody in the middle who intercepts this. So if we go back and intercept it, we try to grab it in the middle, then we won't actually have any information about what's been transmitted. But what's really nice is we've actually transmitted just this state. Now, Alice has a copy over here. So this picture here, very simple, very basic, silly idea, is actually what teleportation is, but it's now for qubits. Now we want to take Alice's qubit and give it to Bob. How do we do that with sharing some prior correlation? Well, it turns out you can't do it if you just share classical correlation. You have to share what's called entanglement. So here's a state of the two systems. Just like in that previous state, we had these 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, and 1, 1. We had those, and we had a description of it where we had 50% 0, 0, 50% 1, 1. Now we have a state whose amplitude is 50%, or is 1 over square root of 2, 0, 0, and is 1 over square root of 2, 1, 1. Okay? So this is the new resource that they can use in order to do this. So what happens is Alice performs an operation on her qubit on the one half of the correlated bits that she had, just like we had those A and B before. And then she sends some information across to Bob. It turns out she sends two bits of information. And the quantum state is now, if Bob does an appropriate operation, he can reconstruct the state on the other side. Alice's state is actually destroyed in this process. But it's exactly this, you're just using this entanglement as a resource, a correlated resource, in order to send quantum information. So that's what quantum teleportation is. Okay, so if we think about it from that perspective, we make that realization, then we say, well, another way to cast what Ron Ross's result is to say that it's that you, if they were to priorly if they were to share entanglement prior to setting up this communication, so let's say, you know, a million years ago, Alice and Bob were able to share this entangled pair, then they can use that in order to cut down their classical communication costs by an exponential amount. Okay? So entanglement can be used for an exponential reduction in the communication resources. It can't be used to actually communicate. This is just some weird correlation that is very quantum mechanical. And that's what I want to explain to you, is that it's like classical correlation, but it's different. Okay? And the thesis that we're going with here, and that has now lots of evidence, is that entanglement is very central to all of the speedups we know in quantum computing, or at least all the exponential ones. So what is entanglement? So one thing about this thing is I told you that, you know, there was a state, this 1 over square root of 2, 0, 0, plus 1 over square root of 2, 1, 1, right? Well, one thing about entanglement is it's like classical correlations as well. You know, those secret bits, that 0, 0 that they each had a half of. You know, they had to create those locally, meaning that they had to create them at some point where they could talk to each other, and then they separate out. And then they have it. But classical correlations are like that, right? You know, if I have these bits that I've shared, that's the same thing. So what is really the difference? Well, let's compare the following situations. We take two quantum systems, we interact them, they go flying away, and now we choose a measurement to perform on them. So we choose some direction to measure these quantum systems, some direction of their spin, say, and then we do the measurement and we get some outcome, right? Now, what we want to do is maybe compare that to a classical situation where we share some classical correlations, so they share some data. We choose some measurement, so, you know, they're going to choose some measurement. And using the classical data, they can now produce some measurement outcome. Okay? So this is an experiment you could imagine doing for the quantum system, and you can imagine carrying this out classically as well. So let's do the quantum experiment first. So they go and they do this. And let's do it for a particular quantum state. And for this particular quantum state, what we're going to do is we're going to specify our measurement by a direction. Okay? So these are going to be spin 1/2 particles that we're measuring, and we're going to measure them along a particular direction. Alice measures along this direction, and Bob can measure along this direction. Okay? And then they produce outcomes. And what those outcomes represent is whether the spin that they're looking at was along that direction or was it going the opposite. So that's +1 or -1. Okay? Those are the measurement outcomes. And this is called the Bell experiment. And when they do this with a particular quantum state that they start out with, they get a certain probability of their outcomes. So here they have their measurement, which they sort of input into the system. They perform the measurement, and they get an outcome. So the probability of getting out these A or B, which are either along or opposite, is given by this expression here. You see that if you take the expectation value over just Alice's output, which is either +1, it's 50% of the time 0, 50% of the time 1. Bob, similarly, is 50% of the time 0, 50% of the time 1. But they're correlated. If you look at their products of their outcomes, it's equal to minus the dot product of those vectors. Okay, so why is this interesting? Well, this experiment, which is the Bell experiment, tells us something because of the following. Let's say we do it with the following setup. We're going to run 4 experiments, okay? And one of them, we're going to put Alice is going to measure along this A1 direction, and Bob's going to measure along his B1, and that, so I've indicated these directions here they're in the plane, okay? And then in another experiment, Alice will do A1, Bob will do B2, and you can calculate out what these correlations are, the product of their outcomes, what it is, and you get these results. This is what quantum theory predicts. Now let's think about if we were to do this in that other picture. Remember, I had the other picture where we just had classical correlations. We just had this information that went across. We chose a measurement. We produced some outcomes. Okay, so what we do is in that case, these parties are choosing their measurement and then producing an outcome, and they're not allowed to talk to each other, right? So they're separated away. So that means that one of the A's of I's can't depend on what measurement the other person was performing or what that outcome was for the other person's measurements. Alice's measurement outcome can't depend on what Bob's measurement outcome or which measurement he was performing, right? And so we can talk about that for these 4 experiments. And then you examine the following quantity. You write it in a little bit different form, and you realize that what happens here is that for the setting of these classical separated correlations, this number has to be bounded by 2. And the way to see that is just to think, well, let's just run this, you know, we may have some probabilities of different things occurring during an event, let's just get rid of that. Let's think about deterministic protocols. What happens in a deterministic protocol? Alice, you know, says I'm measuring 1 or 2, and I output either plus 1 or minus 1. So her A1s are just plus 1 or minus 1, but it can't depend on what Bob does. Right? And then when we factor this, right, if you do that similar argument for Bob, he can't depend on Alice. So if whatever choice is made for B1 and B2, they're either plus or minus 1, one of these two will vanish, right? So if B1 is equal to B2, then the first one will vanish. The first of the two terms will vanish. And if B1 equals minus B2, then the last two terms will vanish. And so this quantity must be less than 2. But if you go and calculate in what the quantum theory says, so we go back and look at the experiments, we find that in quantum theory, this number is actually equal to 2 times square root of 2, just by substituting these guys back in. So what we know, what this tells us, is that it tells us that the correlations in quantum theory, we have this entanglement, and we have these entangled systems. We can't explain it by just simply saying that sometime in the past, these two systems interacted and there was some classical information transmitted out. Okay, so physicists get very excited about this, and they worried about this for a long time. This history of this whole thing has to do with an argument between Einstein and Bohr and Schrodinger, and physicists have spent hours worrying about this. But just to be equal opportunity, I want to tell you about two other people who also worried about it. So it turns out that Alan Turing also worried a lot about the foundations of quantum theory. In fact, he wrote a manuscript, never been published as far as I know, about the quantum Zeno effect. Which is a particular effect in quantum theory. And also John von Neumann is very famous for writing one of the first textbooks about quantum theory. And so the people in the early days worried a ton about this. But what we do now in quantum information science is we take a little different perspective. We stop worrying about the fact that quantum theory is correct. It works. You know, we get to live with it, but it's great. Now we get to think, you know, it does weird things, and so we should really try to love that actual strangeness. And so in the worrying picture, we have the classical and the quantum, and we divide them, and we go, oh, they're different, and we worry about this. But what we really want to do is accept them as a resource, and then we want to actually quantify that resource. We want to say, well, what's the difference? What's the difference from a resource perspective between the quantum correlations and classical correlations plus what could be able to simulate quantum correlations? So here's that gives us a new question. What is the communication cost? What if we now allow, we change the rules a little bit, and a physicist would never do this, but we can do it. You take the data, you separate it out, you share your classical correlations, you choose a measurement, but now you add another step. And in this step, you're allowed to communicate some bits back and forth, okay? And then you make a measurement. So what we're doing here is trying to figure out what the communication complexity of simulating these quantum correlations is. And what you'd like to do, of course, in this thing is you'd actually like to minimize the amount of communication you use. So quantum theory gives us these odd correlations. How do we mimic them, and how do we minimize the amount of communication? Because we want to compare resources. This is a valid protocol that we could carry out. You know, it wouldn't simulate the non-local nature of the correlations, but it would be essential for understanding the difference in the power between classical and quantum computers. So here's a protocol. Look at my time here. Okay. Here's a protocol that actually simulates those Bell correlations. So remember, they want to produce this probability of outcome given by this expression here up at the top. A and B are plus or minus 1, and these vectors are directions. So what makes this hard? Well, one way you could do this, right, is Alice could send her vector to Bob, right? But if I want to do that over a channel, you know, I have some direction now in space, right? And I want to send that direction to you. Well, I can do it, but it's going to require a lot of communication. The question is, can we do it with less? And so there is a protocol that actually does it using a single bit of communication. I don't need to send you, Alice doesn't need to send to Bob her direction in space in order to simulate these correlations. Alice only needs to send a single bit of communication as long as they're also allowed to share some randomness beforehand. So this is the output. They share some random vectors, which are lambda 1 and lambda 2. They produce, so you can just sort of see it in the sketch of what's going on. Alice produces an outcome which depends on her measurement, and also depends on some of the shared information that they have. Alice sends a bit, which depends only on her measurement, the A vector, and some of the shared information. Sends that to Bob, that's a single bit of information. Bob finally then outputs something, which depends on the communicated bit and on the shared information and his direction. Okay? So this means the correlations on a single EBIT, that single unit that I was talking about, are actually equal to something like shared randomness plus one bit of communication. Okay, so there's a real sense in which we've actually talked about now what is the from the original thing, we know that it requires at least one bit of communication. Right here, we now see that we can do it in exactly one bit. And the question that a lot of us are working on, and a question which there's not enough time to talk about, is this conjecture, which I call the finiteness conjecture. And what it says is, you know, what I said was I'm making measurements on a single EBIT. Now, if you do the Ron Ross thing, you have a bunch of EBITs, a bunch of share these quantum correlated systems, right? You have a bunch of them. And you're going to do measurements on them. You want to know how much it costs to communicate. And the conjecture is that all multipartite entangled systems can be exactly simulated. So these quantum correlations can be simulated by using classical shared randomness, these original correlations, plus an amount of communication which is polynomial in the size of the entangled subsystem, the dimensions of the entangled systems. So if we had a qubit, that's a two-dimensional system, right? And if we have two qubits, then we get four, right? So if we have two entangled qubits, then we have four-dimensional entangled subsystems. And so it should scale like that dimension, meaning that it will grow exponentially and quantum mechanics will be exponentially better than classical communication. From which we know from Ross's result must be true. Okay, so there's a lot of result in trying to actually pin this down and say whether this is true or not. And there's a lot of evidence that this might actually be true. And it's actually showing us that maybe there's some deep structure to quantum correlations that we need to understand. We need to develop the theory of classically simulating quantum correlations. Okay, so now I said in the beginning I would tell you about algorithms, right? So what does this have to do with algorithms? So what it turns out to be able to show is that you can sort of quantify how much entanglement a system has. You can take systems and divide them up in a particular way, and then you can say, well, this thing has so much entanglement. So this has been a big push in the early days of quantum information theory, was to really make rigorous what it means to have so much entanglement. What it turns out is that when you calculate that number for a quantum system, you go out and you calculate this number, you actually find out when there's not a lot of entanglement around, then you can write down an efficient classical system for simulating the classical algorithm for simulating the quantum system. So how does this help us in guiding it? Well, it tells us that we need the entanglement. So now we've seen that it helps in the communication complexity. We thought, okay, we really need to pin down what are these correlations and how we try to understand them. But now we can say, well, what does it do for algorithms? So here's an example of how it appears in algorithms. So this is Shor's algorithm. So what Shor did was he wasn't the first to do this, but he reduced factoring to period finding. So I give you some function, f of x, and I want you to, this function is guaranteed to have a period, say some period r, which you don't know and you want to find. And I give you the ability to query this function. You could ask, what is f of 10? And the function will say, it's 15. And, you know, you'll ask another value and it'll give you another one. And you want to say, well, I get to query this, and I want to actually find out what the period is, right? Now, if the period is can be anything, then it's very hard to actually query this and to discover what that period is, right? It takes a long time. It'll take you something like of order this big N time to actually find what the period is. But in quantum algorithms, what you do is you input a state, which is a superposition over all the possible inputs to the function. Then you compute the function, okay? And then after you've computed the function, you take the one half of the system. So this function u of f, if you look down at the bottom here, I've written where you have the function computed every single time and you compute f of x. Now at this point, people always say, well, okay, quantum computers have this vast parallelism, right? But the wrong thing about things, right? If I do a probabilistic description of, if I have a bunch of bits, they're either, 50% up, 50% down. Let's say I have n bits, right? These things all just become 1 over n's for my description of the probabilistic state, right? So counting state space is not going to tell you anything about quantum computing. What is going to tell you about quantum computing is if you look at this first register, and if you actually look at it, there's lots of entanglement in this system, okay? And actually what you do in Shor's algorithm is you perform the Fourier transform after you have lots of entanglement in your system, and you are able to use that to determine the period r. So here's a problem which people have been working on, including myself, for a while, and I want to show you how this notion of entanglement is coming up in algorithms to attack this. And this is called the hidden subgroup problem. So this is the problem that most people in quantum computing spend way too much time working on. So here's the setup. You have some group, make it a finite group, and it's a known group. And you're also given a subgroup of that group, and you don't know that subgroup. Okay? And you're given query access to some function. So you can ask questions of some function, which is a map from that group to some set. And that set, that function is guaranteed to be constant and distinct on left cosets of the subgroup. So there's a subgroup. So if you look at my picture down here, here's the group G. You have the big group. And then you have the hidden subgroup H, right? And then you have the different cosets that partition up G. And there's a function which now maps each of the elements in those cosets to unique values of the set. This is the hidden subgroup problem. What you want to do is you want to, in this problem, you want to actually find a generating set for H. You want to identify what H is, right? And you want to do it, and efficient here means something which is polynomial in the log of the size of the group. Oops. Okay, so why do we care about this? It turns out Shor's factoring algorithm is an example of this for an abelian group of an unknown size, but it's a hidden subgroup problem. If you could find a solution for the hidden subgroup problem for the symmetric group, you'd be able to use that to find an efficient algorithm for graph isomorphism problem. Okay? If you could find an algorithm for the hidden subgroup problem for the dihedral group, you would actually find an efficient algorithm for the poly-D unique shortest vector in a lattice. Here you get a claim that you would break some crypto systems, which everybody likes to break crypto systems. How does this guide us in, how does this entanglement guide us in trying to understand these? We don't know how to, the big open questions in quantum computing, we don't know how to solve the hidden subgroup problem over the symmetric group or the dihedral group. How do we use the insights we've had about entanglement? Well, if you look at the dihedral hidden subgroup problem, you do this standard thing. You input the sum instead of all these x's, now they're elements of the group. You feed them into the function that you're querying. You can simultaneously compute all of them before. And if you actually look at the system that comes out on the other side, you discover something very interesting. You discover that that thing doesn't have a lot of entanglement. It doesn't have a lot of entanglement, and there's actually no way to make an entangling measurement which will give you any extra actual benefit in information. It turns out you get very low-dimensional systems that have some amount of entanglement in them. So what this means is that using the dihedral hidden subgroup problem, we know that there's going to be an efficient classical algorithm for any quantum one that we come up with here, as long as we're not doing some crazy entangled measurement, which we know because it has a low dimensionality doesn't help us. So that means that we have to do something more sophisticated, and what we actually do is we have to take k copies of the hidden subgroup state. So you take k copies of these states. So you take that low-dimensional thing that I had there, and you take a bunch of copies of that, and now you perform an operation which is a measurement in an entangled basis across all of those. And so this is it. This is the method that you would have to use, that we're guided to just know we have to use this method in order to actually get any quantum speed up if it's there. So it's been known for a while, since 99, by Edinger, Hoyer, and Hill, that actually you need that it's sufficient to have log the size of the group copies of these hidden subgroup states. So you have, you know, I said k of them here. That can be log the size of the group. Okay. So that's been known for a long time. And what we've recently been able to show is that we can actually write down what the optimal measurement is. So if we are given a hidden subgroup with equal probability from all the possible hidden subgroups, we can actually construct what the optimal measurement is for distinguishing those hidden subgroups. And it turns out that this hidden subgroup, for the dihedral hidden subgroup problem, this actually turns out you need log the size of the group copies. So we now know that it's both necessary and sufficient. The other thing we have is, again, as we expected, this measurement that we get out, which is the optimal measurement to perform in order to extract what the hidden subgroup is, that measurement is actually in an entangled basis. And probably even more interesting and very suggestive of maybe something that's going on here is that the success probability of the measurements for distinguishing this is actually related to the subset sum problem. Okay, so the subset sum problem, you're given k integers from Zn, and some target, and you want to say, does there exist a subset of those integers which actually sums to the target T? And this problem has some nice properties if you define the density of the problem. Density of the problem is the number of copies divided by the length of the bit screen describing the numbers. So in the low density regime, when K is less than 1, most of the subsets have a distinct sum. And in the high density regime, most sums are achieved by some subset. So there's a transition in this. And what's known about this problem is we know that there are efficient algorithms for this, efficient classical algorithms for this, for the low-density regime and the high-density regime. And we just speculate that it might be hard in the middle. And what happens is that this transition, this fact that you have most subsets have a distinct sum going to most sums achieved by subset, means that in the dihedral hidden subgroup problem, when we actually do the calculation, the probability of success is exactly related to these two numbers. And below, so this density, below the density 1, you have basically no probability of actually distinguishing the subgroup. And then greater than 1, you get a probability of 1. Okay, so there's something weird that's going on here, is that that phase transition in this average case problem. So now if I talk about average, you know, I randomly select problems here and I randomly select problems over there, that average case complexity is somehow related to the difficulty of the dihedral hidden subgroup problem. So this, I sort of like it simply because it pulls together a lot of things. You get all of the thing that we know, that we need classical computation, right? We need this entanglement. But all of a sudden we see this phase transition and this complexity problem. Why is this going on? Is there something deep here? I'm not sure. Okay, so I've told you about what. Now in my remaining time, I get to talk to you about how. Because so far I've just assumed I have a quantum computer, right? And, you know, that's a pretty big assumption. So how do you do this? So first we should talk about how to build a classical computer. Let's start a little easier. One way to talk about building a classical computer is to look back at our history. Then think about if you were around in 1938. Hopefully, I wasn't around then. Some people were. But we could ask, how do we want to build a classical computer? And one difficulty you might face is you look around at the hardware you have and you go, oh, man, these things aren't very reliable. So we try to solve these problems. And how do we solve them? Well, one way to solve them in the communication regime is, just coding, right? It's the mathematical theory of computation, Claude Shannon, 1948. So it's how to communicate the presence of noise. We also have to worry about, when we're building a computer, though, more than just communication. We have to worry about actually building reliable computers out of faulty components, right? And so this is what John von Neumann did in 1956, where he constructed this theory. Of course, he was very interested in biology, where he constructed this theory where he could compute with subsystems of when the subsystems of your computer actually fail, right? So he was able to do this. But we don't need these, right? Those things are gone. They're history. You know, you might learn about them because they're fun. Well, this one, the top one, you learn about for more important reasons, of course, right? But you don't see them in the computation. You don't see them in our computers. Why? And why is that? Well, the reason is that the physics of these devices, of the integrated circuit and the hard drive, the sort of two models of what we think about when we're thinking about storage and manipulation of information, these things actually enact the methods of the theory of what von Neumann and Shannon were talking about in the devices. Okay. So how do they do that? Well, you can just sort of sketch how they do that, right? How does it work in a hard drive? I'll just talk about the hard drive. It does a majority vote of magnetism. You have some domain. Most of the spins, you try to encode your information, you try to put them all pointing up, right? Some of them like to flip around and go the opposite direction, right? But you have a majority vote. You count the total magnetization. That's a redundancy code, right? How does error correction occur in these things? Well, the system doesn't like you to flip some of these. If I have, start with all of them spins pointing up, I flip some, the surrounding spins like to flip them back over, right? It's energetically favorable to go back. And the system likes to minimize that, likes to keep, at below the critical temperature, likes to actually fix the errors, and so you actually have a robustness. Okay, and there's a similar story that goes on in the integrated circuit if you actually think about how it's enacting the principles of error correction and fault tolerance. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about that hard drive, just sort of get a perspective as to what's going on, and just sort of to point out some things you wouldn't do when you're building your classical computer. So we take what's called the EC model. So this is a model in which you take the energy of your system is proportional to this expression up at the top here. Well, what I've done is each spin, so you have a lattice of spins, and each of these spins is either +1, -1, pointing up, pointing down. And then the energy of the system is equal to this expression where we sum over, a contribution that if they're aligned, then that gives a minus J contribution, and if they're anti-aligned, they're pointing in opposite directions, then it gives a plus J contribution. So the system likes to have that, right? And we can encode information into this system. So this thing at the top is describing the energy of the system. right? And then we have two examples here, one-dimensional, two-dimensional, and we can encode information in there. We could try putting the information. Let's just start out with all of the spins pointing in one direction. And then you can ask, well, what happens when we turn on some temperature? So we add some noise to the system. So let's turn on the temperature, and what happens is in one dimension, the system disorders, right? So you don't want to build your memory in one dimension because the system will normalize, and you'll actually lose that information. So the total magnetization is an indication that the information's still there. But in two dimensions, everything's fine. So why is that? Well, here's the picture of what's going on. Suppose we start with everything going in, everything pointing up, right? So we're in the ground state of this thing. We're at the lowest energy. Now we flip one of the spins. Well, what does that do? It violates two of those bonds, right? So now I have two frustrated ones that now contribute plus J to the total energy. So I go up in energy, right? Now I could flip another neighbor, and I sort of go across because flipping a neighbor doesn't cost any energy, right? Okay, and if you continue on this way, you can flip the next neighbor and the next neighbor and the next neighbor, and you can eventually flip the entire state. I've destroyed the information. I've gone from all up to all downs via just going up in energy and across, right? And so what you say in physics is you say, well, the disorder and entropy of this process, there's a lot of states that are basically in this BC manifold up there, is greater than the energy. So if you calculate the free energy of this process, you can quickly show that. What's nice to observe is that the excitations in this are point-like, meaning that if I flip a spin, it's as if there are two particles at those bonds. You flip the next one, the particle hops over. Okay? What happens in two dimensions, you have a bunch of spins, you encode some information, you flip one of the spins, now you break four of those bonds. You try to flip a neighbor, now you've flipped six, and you see that the energy scales like the perimeter, right? And so the system will have a hard time getting over this energy barrier to fix itself. And if you actually do the calculation and count the entropy, you see that the disorder in entropy in the system is much less than the energy. Okay, so what do we have to do? Okay, so let me finish up here. So what I want to do is now I want to take this over and talk about quantum computation, right? So that was classical computers, how they worked. Everything in quantum computing is more complicated. Instead of probabilistics, we have qubits. Instead of evolution, that was, you know, digital evolution, say, we now have unitary evolution. Measurements, now quantum. So this looks very analog, right? Because we have to specify a unitary rotation, which has all these degrees of freedom, right? On the other hand, you know, if you look at it from that perspective, then you miss this also the perspective that if you have a probabilistic computer, there are probabilities. You know, do we have to compute the probabilities exactly? Well, it turns out we don't, right? That's one of the nice discoveries of classical computer science. So it actually turns out to be even worse. You know, this is sort of this picture of the qubit is something that's sort of analog, right? It's even worse. The system here is just a closed quantum system. Turns out that real quantum systems couple to environments, right? So your quantum system, which might be, say, an ion in a trap, and you're manipulating the hyperfine levels, two low levels in its energy spectrum, that's your qubit, right? That system's going to couple to your environment because it's very hard to isolate these. And what happens is your quantum system becomes mixed. It becomes classical. The system decoheres. And so you've lost the quantum information. So you have to figure out how to fix this. Okay? And what people did is they discovered that they could fix this. And they fixed it in a way which is very similar to what Shannon was talking about. They realized that information could be encoded. So I can take a quantum system, and the fact that I have a qubit in a two-level system in an ion, as opposed to having a qubit in, you know, some subspace which is two-dimensional over a bunch of qubits, it's still a qubit. Right, I can encode information into a bunch of different quantum systems, into the state of a bunch of different quantum systems. And when I do that, this allows me to actually protect the information. So I can construct what's called a quantum error correcting code. So I can take my quantum information, I can encode it across a bunch of qubits. Here I have a single qubit encoded into five qubits. Errors now occur on this, but if few errors occur to the system, you know, in the similar same way that if, you know, a bunch of errors occur to an error correcting code, you're in trouble. But if small enough number occur, then you're able to actually diagnose that error and fix it. And this is the quantum equivalent to Shannon's noisy coding theorem, basically, this type of construction. And it turns out that there's actually a threshold result very similar to von Neumann. Now we worry about not just this fact that we have decoherence coupling to external environment. We also worry about the fact that we have noisy gates. We can't do those rotations correctly. We have faulty measurements. And what people were able to show in 95, 96 was that if that error rate is small enough, then you can actually do robust quantum computation. And this actually, without quantum error correction, there really is no theory of quantum computation. It's really essential to even establishing it as a valid model of computation. But in spite of this, this beautiful result, I don't think this is the way quantum computers will be built. And why is that? Well, it's because we forgot what I started with, which was physics. This threshold result is missing physics. It's this very complicated, very beautiful construction to get you to this threshold. But it misses the point that the reason that we could do classical computation was we had these robust medium. So we can ask, you know, the billion-dollar question. It may be more than a billion if you could actually solve it. You know, are there physical systems where you can actually encode information into the systems, quantum information into the systems, but the physics of the device will actually allow you to have robust quantum computation? Okay? So a picture of what something like this might look like is something we call a self-correcting quantum computer. And it's the following sort of picture. What you imagine is you have, say, a bunch of qubits, and these are strongly coupled together. So here I've demonstrated some couplings between these things, and imagine this in a big cubic lattice. So this is a quantum many-body system, right? And what you can show is that I can encode quantum information into this system, and the excitations in a Meade field model look very much like they're string-like excitations, meaning that as you do errors on the system, either bit flip errors, which are classical errors, or phase errors, which are quantum errors, it actually has excitations which look string-like. And the question is does this system actually allow us to store quantum information? And what's amazing about this is the fact that this would lead you to something which is a new sort of order parameter in such a system. It's a coherence order parameter. It's an order parameter describing the fact that the quantum information is still around, just like the total magnetization told you that the classical information was still around. So, you know, this seems very crazy. You have all these interactions. How might you do this? One possible thing is to actually implement this is in optical lattices. So these are really cool dual devices where you shine lasers at each other, basically create standing waves, and then you can trap neutral atoms in them. So you can create these arrays of neutral atoms in these standing waves of light, and just kind of sitting there. And then you can actually, using them, you can actually manipulate the lasers such that these neutral atoms then interact in exactly this type of interaction. And you know, the goal of a self-correcting quantum computer would, if you build this, you wouldn't have to do that error correcting, that whole thing that people do to get to the threshold theorem. You would just have a physical system which has robust storage. So this is a very big divergence, and I'm, you know, speculating now as to what will happen. But there's sort of the traditional way people think about building a quantum computer. We have 5 atoms, 6 atoms, you know, 7 atoms, more and more. We build larger and larger ones until we get to the point where we can do enough quantum error correction and we're below this threshold, and we have to do all this microarchitecture on the quantum error correction. We might not have to do that. If we can find self-correcting, or if we can engineer self-correcting systems whose physics basically enacts the quantum error correcting procedure, then we won't have to do this, and we'll be able to construct systems where we just already have a robust qubit. All right, so hopefully I've given you a little bit of view of what quantum computers can do. Hopefully I've argued a little bit that entanglement is essential to this, and that one of the important goals of quantum information is to understand entanglement, and to understand it not from the old perspective of entanglement strange, we should all worry. Entanglement should be understood as a resource, and we should compare it to other classical resources and understand the trade-offs between the two so that we can really try to understand where quantum computers are getting their power. Hopefully I've also maybe argued, maybe convinced you in the end that there's an alternative path towards building a quantum computer which doesn't involve, you know, this very large construction with a huge device complexity overhead of the fault-tolerant construction, but maybe involves engineering systems that are just naturally robust. So thank you for your time. Classical computation is contained within quantum computation.
Can you tell a little more about the last device you mentioned? What is the capacity of the current point? I mean, did you actually implement that?
So this one, back the final thing I talked about here.
So this system here that I'm talking about encodes a single qubit. And it so it'll be a single qubit. It hasn't been constructed. The big question is, are these, I have mean field arguments about why this works, but I don't know if it actually is self-correcting. The other thing is it's just designed to be a memory at this point. And so you can do some simple manipulations on the information, but you can't build a full universal quantum computer out of it yet.
All right. So thank you.